History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. For the last 2 to 3 years, if pundits on the left and the right in the United States agree on anything, it's that our democracy is in crisis. This can be characterized by an eroding of civil institutions, or maybe it's politicians ignoring democratic norms and basically doing whatever they can to ask, where are the nuclear launch codes for power? And it doesn't matter what institution I destroy, whether how legislation gets passed, what the judiciary does, doesn't matter. I just want power. But these challenges might not be so new. And the fault lines in American society might not be only a few years old, but could be centuries old, and stem back to the beginning of the Enlightenment, when scholars asked fundamental questions about how we know what is and isn't true, and how do we order our society along these principles. And different intellectuals had different solutions. So on the one hand, you could end up with the American Revolution. On the other, you could have the Reign of Terror in France. But today's guest, Seth David Radwell, a researcher of the Enlightenment and a business leader with a master's degree in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School, argues that our political divisions aren't unprecedented. In his new book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation, he proposes a new dialogue between concerned Americans from both red and blue states. So what he did in his book, and what we look at in our discussion, is to examine long-held assumptions about American democracy and ideals. And there are two different enlightenments that have worked throughout American history. The radical enlightenment, which is sort of exemplified by the Declaration of Independence, which introduced very radical ideas at the time, like that all men are created equal, and the more moderate enlightenment, which is what the U.S. Constitution represented, how to order society in a controlled way. Now, different approaches to the enlightenment have been useful at different times of history, and there's been a back and forth. Radwell argues that finding the right balance can help heal some of the partisan wounds in the United States. So we enjoy this discussion with Seth Radwell. Seth, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure for me to be here, Scott. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, we are really going to get into it. We're talking about not only American history and the ideas of the Enlightenment, but why there are two Americas today due to epistemological differences and differences in time. So we're going to tackle some pretty big ideas, which I like to do on the show. So let's jump right in. What motivated you to begin this topic, to say that Americans live in different enlightenments?
Well, it's a great question. What motivated me, Scott, was over the past couple of years, I grew increasingly distressed as I watched our political discourse collapse. And so I was surprised at how much it became impossible with my colleagues in business and personal life to discuss issues, because it seemed that rancor and acrimony had crowded out reason. And so, I'm a business person. I was most recently CEO of a consumer products company, and I built a great business career. But I took a three-year hiatus to really investigate the historical roots, the antecedents of our divisions, because I felt that we as Americans, besides being trapped in a partisan bubble, which sometimes you hear, we really are trapped in a time bubble. And I knew that our current situation wasn't so unique. We as a country have been divided for a long time and in many eras. So I went on this journey to do investigative journalism, so to speak. And I've read a lot of history, hundreds of books and articles, to try to get to the root of our divisions.
All right. Well, a lot to start with there. So let's start out with time bubbles. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So we think that everything that happens today is unique, that there's no precedence. Well, it turns out our divisions really started back at our founding. And while many Americans, even if they have kind of a superficial knowledge of history, and they remember from high school, our founding fathers, sometimes they think that they're monolithic, and that's not at all the case. During the 18th century, in our founding, and I believe, by the way, this is very instructional for where we are today, there were two discrete types of thought about the Enlightenment, which was, of course, the era we were in at that point. Now, I'll come back to later what's so interesting about that, because the word Enlightenment itself has almost become a dirty word. But it was, in fact, really important in our founding. And there were two different philosophical schools of political thought at the time, one which I call the moderate Enlightenment and one I call the radical Enlightenment. And it turns out that our founding fathers were competing. Their ideas were vying for prominence from these two schools. So what were they? Well, on the radical side, you had people like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, and Thomas Jefferson, who really believed in the concept that was developed by, in the French Radical Enlightenment, of the notion of egalitarian representative democracy as being the only form of a social contract that was legitimate. So remember, we're in this period of time, the social contract is the construct for why we're in a society at all, right? And many philosophers had written about that over the years. But it was the radicals who thought that the form of that contract should be a representative democracy. And the moderates, on the other hand, people like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, were very much enamored with the aristocratic model of ruling, where the elites themselves ruled. And I'll come back to that. The second key difference between the radicals and the moderates, to make it simple for a second, so your listeners can understand where I'm coming from, is the notion that the radicals believed in a separation of church and state, for a firm one. They had documented in great detail how in history, the church and the monarchy had colluded to keep the people oppressed. And so famously, Jefferson wrote, you know, we not only need freedom from religion, but freedom of religion, but freedom from religion. So whereas the moderates were much more comfortable having the church play a role. So to make it simple, in a nutshell, those were the big differences between these two schools, but it was tremendously contentious. It ended up causing a huge split in the country between the Federalists and what became the Federalists and the Republicans. And in the book, American Schism, I trace the period of time from the Declaration of Independence, which was a very radical time, to when the Constitution was written 12 years later, where it became much more moderate. And that evolution from radicalism to moderate solutions, I believe, is very instructive for what became a pattern in American history.
Right. And for listeners, if this rings any bells, this is a thing I've talked about a little bit, where this idea of the radical enlightenment, where people thought, wow, this idea of democracy that was used in Athens 2000 years ago, if these ideas from the ancient past are being brought alive and new, perhaps anything is possible. And so I did an episode on utopian communities, specifically in Iowa, and how others thought, well, let's try the idea of a utopia and see if this radical idea that many thought impossible actually came true, if these other ideas can come true. So radical enlightenment, you describe that. When I hear that, they think of the French Revolution or Robespierre and the Reign of Terror and other things like that. Are you speaking of something different, though? Or are you talking about within the United States and these different views of the enlightenment?
So that's a great question, because Robespierre was the antithesis of the radical enlightenment, which I go into in some detail. So let me be a little bit more specific about this split. In the U.S., the moderates really did not believe in democracy. For them, they eschewed democracy. Democracy meant demagogues. And they were very fearful of, because many people were uneducated at the time, although it was the colonies were becoming more educated, they felt that people might be easily swayed by demagogues, people pretending to advocate for the interests of the populace while they were actually seeking gain. So the moderates were very, very skeptical of democracy. And John Adams and Alexander Hamilton were two great examples, who thought that expertise and competency was important in governing, which of course the educated elite class had. Now, the French Revolution, which was the parallel to the American Revolution, in fact, the radicals like Thomas Jefferson believed that the American and French revolutions were part of one wave of developing of a modern society. But the French Revolution went through three phases. And after the storm of the Bastille, without going into too much history, but then this is in the book in detail, there was a wonderfully radical enlightenment phase led by people like Condorcet and Brissot, where a very democratic constitution was written, and the Declaration of Rights of Man, of course, which was second only to the Declaration of Independence, was probably one of the most important documents to reflect radical Enlightenment views. And then a charter that really laid out the whole importance of education, because the French radicals realized that if they were to have a democracy, it required an educated populace. So they laid out what would be required to educate people in what today we'd call civics or civic society. Now, The French Revolution had a very bloody aftermath because this counter-Enlightenment force, which is described in great detail in the book American Schism, came into place, which overthrew the kind of the rational and rejected reason. And that's a lesson for your listeners and for my readers about what would happen often in America, which is that these two forces that we're discussing, the radical Enlightenment and the moderate Enlightenment, battling for how to govern with very valid observations and ideas, ended up becoming more and more confronted by what I call in the book the counter-Enlightenment, which rejected reason altogether. And so, you know, by the way, I should point out, Scott, that this framework about the radical and moderate Enlightenment is not mine. I didn't develop it. In fact, I've read many, many books about the Enlightenment. And one of the prominent Enlightenment scholars is a professor named Jonathan Israel. And he came up with this framework quite a few years ago. And I've read much of his work. Now, why was his framework so important? Well, much written about the Enlightenment, and there's been a lot written about the Enlightenment, categorizes the Enlightenment by geography. We speak of the British Enlightenment, you know, Locke, or the Scottish Enlightenment, and the German Enlightenment, and the French Enlightenment. What Israel maintains and has done great research to prove or to substantiate is that the geography is a good distinction, but in fact, there's a better way to characterize Enlightenment thinkers, which of course were very diverse and vast. So there's no one easy model to categorize the whole Enlightenment. But there was a trend towards these two schools of radical and moderate, which cut across geography. And so his framework, which I adapted, he ended up writing, of course, the foreword for the book, because he was very intrigued by this take. His framework is very applicable, I think, to understanding these different ideas that were percolating in our founding. And you know, besides being so important in our founding, the book then traces these two schools throughout our history up until today.
All right, well, let's look at that. And it's interesting to chart the evolution and see when one is ascendant and the other is descendant and vice versa. So you mentioned earlier the decade plus period from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution, where the Declaration of Independence is radical, the Constitution is moderate. Could you briefly describe what that means? And then is the moderate Enlightenment then ascendant or has
prominence?
Yeah, it has prominence in the United States for a period of time after that.
Well, what the book shows, I'll give the answer ahead of time before I get to the details of that decade. The book shows that there's a pendulum-like swing between moderate and radical feeling and thought through our history. So at times we shifted more towards the moderate Enlightenment view, and at times the pendulum swung back to more of the radical view. And many times, of course, counter-Enlightenment ideas overlaid on top of these two with unpredictable effects. So that's what the book gets into. But your question is more specific, which is what happened between the spirit of 1776 and the time our Constitution was first written and then ratified. And the answer is that the spirit of 76 was an era when the colonists increasingly were realizing how abusive they viewed the British monarchy and the British system for the colonies in terms of taxes, onerous duties, troops on American soil, in fact, threatening the idea of self-government. And so the radical expression of those ideas was most embodied in the Declaration of Independence, which was primarily written by Jefferson, but there was a committee who worked on it. And let's talk about that, the Declaration of Independence. It states that all men are created equal, which is itself quite a radical idea given the history of the prior 1,000 years. And it states that God-given rights, inalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness cannot be taken from people, that they're God-given and they must be preserved by the state. Now, those two ideas are incredibly radical and were consistent with the radical enlighteners all over the world. But what's interesting to me is that the document itself was the example of an Enlightenment argument. In other words, the Enlightenment, besides its political ideas, was all about human capacity. It was about the ability of humans to observe the universe, empirical observation, and to reason, to use their God-given facilities of reason to make conclusions and learn about the world. And so the Declaration of Independence in its most pure form is a rational argument. It says, you know, we believe that people have this God-given set of rights, and the government has to preserve those rights. And if the government is failing to do so, and by the way, we have a long list of examples of why they're failing to do so, then we have a right to put in a new government. I mean, that is in essence the Declaration of Independence. It's an argument with detail, with evidence. Okay, so radical period 76. Well, what happened by the Constitution? It turns out, Scott, that as we say sometimes, you know, there's 1,000 critics for every playwright. Once after the war was over and it became time to unify what were 13 very distinct colonies with different ideas, the early nation needed practical solutions. It had to figure out how to pay for the war, how to have a foreign policy, because as a young nation, the United States needed allies, how to regulate commerce across the colonies, now states. So there were practical problems that needed solving. And sometimes the details are messy. And the overall point being, by the time we got to the 1780s, when and 1787, when solutions were acquired, the moderates at that point that were probably better, since the radicals were slightly more idealist, the moderates had more concrete solutions. The best example, of course, of this is Alexander Hamilton. He was a genius who could design almost anything, and he was able to put into place systems that were very practical for the young nation. So my point being, during this time, and by the way, the story is around it are fascinating, because Jefferson himself, who was one of the prominent radicals, was away being ambassador to France. So Madison, James Madison, who was his colleague, was the responsible for going back and forth between Jefferson's ideas and this idealist view and the concerns of the moderates in terms of actually drafting the Constitution. But it ended up being very moderate. What we ended up with, having started with all men are created equal, in the Constitution, we end up with those that have a voice in the government are white men with property. Quite a far cry from all men are created equal. And the Constitution has a bunch of compromises between this radical view and the moderate view. But these are, again, compromises. For example, the radical view of a representative democracy as being a governing mechanism is merely in the Constitution one aspect. It's what elects the House of Representatives. Remember, the Senate is appointed in the Constitution, is appointed by the states, and the president is elected by this electoral college concept. So it wasn't as if democracy was pure at all in the Constitution. It was a mix of what's called a mixed government model, which was very specific to how governance was in Britain, according to the British enlighteners like Locke and Montesquieu. There was a balance of powers between elements of democracy, but also elements of a chief executive and of elites, etc. So that really describes the shift, which the book goes into in some detail, between this radical era of 76 and this much more moderate era of 1787. And before I finish this segment, I do want to point out one last thing for your listeners, because this is vital. While they recognized that the framers of the Constitution, that there were many compromises, they also knew that it was impossible to design a blueprint for the credo of the Declaration without making it modifiable. They knew that the colonies were young and were going to change. And so they built into the Constitution the notion that it would be modified every generation, which of course sometimes we lose sight of today. We think that it's immutable. Last time we made a meaningful change to the Constitution was in the 70s. So anyway, I think that era, from this transition from the radical period of 1776 to the very moderate, solution-oriented environment of 1787, is a very useful example of this swing between radical and moderate that continued through our history.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. It's interesting to wonder where a radical and where a moderate Enlightenment framework have their places. And by means of example, you discuss President Lincoln and what happens after the Civil War, which by all means, people would universally agree that the United States changes in a meaningful way. Those who praise Lincoln would say that he essentially resolved the contradictions or the unfinished business of the Revolution, the issue of slavery. What is the relationship between the federal government and the state government? Because the Confederates argued that we are simply following the blueprint given to us by our forefathers, and we have the right to be able to break away from a foreign power, much as we did away from England. Brothers would say that what Lincoln did was to renegotiate this contract, but do so in a way so that sort of like the Hamiltonian view of the United States was something that ultimately succeeded, and it created institutions robust enough to be able to allow the United States to function effectively. But what's interesting is that Lincoln, I mean, depending on how you look at him, he could be radical on one hand, or he could be someone who's moderate, who's trying to shore up federal power. So where does Lincoln fit on this continuum, and when is radical good and when is moderate good?
Once again, for your listeners, I'll give the punchline first. The book goes through many examples of this shift. And at the end, it argues that both the radical enlightenment and the moderate enlightenment have contributions to make, that a balance of the two is important. What's most dangerous for our democracy, the book argues, is the counter-enlightenment, is the rejection of reason and objective truth in the public arena. And of course, that's very relevant today because, as I mentioned at the start, much of our discourse today has been seemingly crowded out by rancor and acrimony, leaving little space for objective truth. So we can come back to that. Lincoln, in my view, and of course, the radical and moderate schools of thought evolved and changed over time. But the reason why Lincoln was a radical is because he embraced this notion from the Declaration as being the credo, the prime credo of America, that what the promise is that all men are created equal. And that for Lincoln, the Constitution was an attempt to provide a blueprint for how to operate against that credo, but it fell short. Famously, we have more work to do for Lincoln in terms of finishing the promise made in the Declaration. And the radical Republicans in Congress in Reconstruction very much viewed that as recreating, fixing the Constitution so that it met the demands of the Declaration, which is what the Reconstruction amendments were all about. Now, interestingly, so that period represented a big shift of the pendulum towards the radical side. In the late 1760s in the southern states, African-American voter registration was up to 70-80%, and African-Americans were voting. When Reconstruction fell apart after 1873, by 1880, I think less than 5% of African-Americans voted. So the pendulum came crashing back, if you will, to a different result. And that, again, is another good example. But to come back to your question, I think in many ways, because of his firm belief in the prominence of the Declaration and the notion of equality as a fundamental part of the American credo, I think Lincoln has to be viewed as a radical enlightener. There were certainly elements of his governance that were more moderate.
When in American history do you think the radical enlightenment has been the most useful and maybe most dangerous? And when has the moderate enlightenment been the most useful and the most dangerous?
That's a great question, Scott, because both are useful and both can be dangerous. I would say that, for example, the civil rights era of the 60s, which is, again, discussed as a whole chapter of the book American Schism, is a great example when radical enlightenment ideals, interestingly, often prompted from a faith-based movement. So it is true that faith can be a major factor driving radical enlightenment ideals. But anyway, that period of time really provided almost an eye-opening for Americans on just how much, even though there was no such thing as de jure slavery anymore, that there was de facto an incredible oppression of African Americans. And so we could discuss that period, but I think that was a great benefit. Now, in terms of dangers, well, when populism, which is a term for governance by the non-elite, by the people, there are many times when populist movements that nobly are trying to get more people involved in governance can be influenced for political treachery. And I won't use current eras, because I'll stay away from the current era. But you had examples of that, for example, in Jacksonia. You mentioned Jacksonian democracy. I mean, that was that Jackson was really the first populist. He really, to his credit, he said, you know what, these moderates, the elites running the country, he embraced real people. And in fact, I think in Jackson's administration, the U.S. became the democracy with the most people voting. I think all white men could vote by the time Jackson was out of office. So in many ways, Jackson was a populist who embraced this radical ideal. Now, we could argue, and historians much more schooled than I, and perhaps yourself, Jackson's intent and his goals about promoting that type of populism, very, very unclear. He certainly was very brutal to Native Americans, and he was not an advocate for African-American liberty. So I think the book chronicles how populism, which is a seemingly radical ideal, has often been used to negative consequences. I'll give you another example, because I think it's such a great question. Let's go back to Jefferson. His radical Enlightenment idea was to be left alone. He had the notion of an idyllic republic, where in his world, it was an agrarian economy where people had their plot of land. Of course, the great contradiction was that he was a slave owner, which we could come back to. But his vision for what the republic was to be free of the control of any central government, whether it be Britain or whether it be Washington, D.C., So for much of our history, this notion of state sovereignty or local sovereignty, which is a radical Enlightenment ideal, has been used for oppression. It's what led the Solid South to regain the toe in enforcing segregation and denying African Americans voting rights. There are many examples of how it was used in a spirit that was contrary to the Declaration of Independence. So we can discuss that. Now, let me go to the other side of your question. I mentioned, so we used examples of how radical Enlightenment can be both beneficial and also dangerous. Well, what about moderate Enlightenment? Moderate Enlightenment, like elites and intelligent, educated people governing, has been wonderful for solutions. I mean, Alexander Hamilton, as an original moderate Enlightener, created tremendously good systems. But it's also why today we feel often that elites are out of touch with America, that the country is being run by what we call the establishment, which are a bunch of elites who really have no sense of what it's like to go to the grocery store and buy food, or to fill up your car with gas. And we've certainly had a problem over our history of American history where the elite class or the established class have not advocated for the working class. So those are some of the dangers of the moderate model being promulgated as a unique form of rule. Was that a helpful answer to your question?
Yeah, I mean, because the context at different points in history and the challenges that are faced are different. So the challenges of the 1930s and the Depression that do require seemingly more radical solutions is different from the 1950s when America, they would have to try to screw things up because there's no other advanced economy that isn't bombed out for World War II. So you just can't help but win. So yeah, it really does change over time. I think you've studied the Enlightenment, but you're also an expert in public policy. And there's a lot of discussion, at least in this current decade, about voting coalitions changing, how, I don't know, college-educated white people will be shifting from one party to another, and then the working-class coalition, traditionally Democratic, is changing. There's all sorts of discussion. And when I was looking at your book, and to take a kind of different example, but I think it relates just as well, is when movements shift from different types of enlightenments, from moderate to radical, I wonder if it's a case of that the explicit social contract or the official social contract doesn't match the unofficial. So let's say I'm thinking about my children and college. And I thought, we're really following a baby boomer script that worked for the baby boomers, but doesn't work anymore. The script was, go to college, you'll get a white collar job. Yes, in 1970, if you went to college and you worked summer jobs at the car wash, you could pay your full freight tuition and leave and get a job as a salesman at IBM, even though you studied philosophy. In 2020, you will have $200,000 of debt. You are guaranteed nothing if you are not a STEM major, but your high school guidance counselor still tells you that. So the official social contract is baby boomer, which worked for them, but doesn't work today. Then there are people calling for Some are saying college education be fully funded. Others say, let's just tear down the whole rotten edifice. It doesn't do what it claimed to do. And me as a refugee from higher education, I have my own radical ideas, which I will not get into because that would derail the conversation. But I very much understand like the disgust that it doesn't do what it claims to do. And so how do shifts like that happen? How do you see the pendulum change? And do you have any ideas about what you think is needed in this decade?
Absolutely. The whole third part of American Schism, of the book, talks about how to move forward from where we are today. And I think, in fact, it really is a call to action, because to your point, a lot of what's happening today it needs updating, is broken. The book does discuss why education is so vital. One of the things that I find extremely frustrating about today is that we spend more time fighting with each other as opposed to building the country and moving forward, as of course China continues to advance. So we seem to find a way to fight about everything. And that to me is a real problem. Now, what I would say is that the book lays out three questions in the third part that are fundamental to answer, separate from the dialogue that we have today about sometimes crazy and seemingly off-topic issues. And one of the questions is, do we as a populace, do we believe in a bottom-up form of government of the people? Because let's put it in context, Scott, the world is moving towards autocracy. If the 20th century was a struggle between an open society like ours against fascism and communism, the 21st century, in my mind, is starting off as a battle between that open liberal society and autocracy, which you've got not only in China and Russia, but in Hungary and other places, Turkey. So you're an expert on Turkey. Erdogan's rule is fascinating in its own. But my point being this, we are in a struggle right now between an open society and autocracy. Let's face it, democracy is a hard form of government. It's not easy. And my research in the book, though, shows that 70% of Americans, so a clear majority, are what I call the frustrated majority. They think that the arguments on the extreme left and right are not helpful. And they believe in the notion of self-governance, a government of the people. So we have to struggle with that question a bit, because if we do believe in it, then we have to realize that here's what's required: an educated populace, not only educated in STEM, but with a knowledge of civics, an ability to evaluate information, to say that not everything on the internet they see is true. There are many other aspects to this example of self-governance that are fascinating to look at. And so really understanding and committing to democracy is the first question. And I'll stop there for a second, because the third part of the book then goes on to a couple of other fundamental questions, which really are at the root of a lot of our disputes today and need to be discussed. But that's certainly one of them. Do we believe that the United States, as an example of the successful experiment in self-government, which has been less corrupt and more open than most, is that still an important model that we stick to?
Here's a question too about, you mentioned the fuel of what makes these different models, whether moderate or radical enlightenment, work are reasoning and objective information and other things like that. I'm curious if you see historical examples where this really worked well, because today for media models, it's click-based, it's viewership rate. If you can do outrage, if you can analytical models, I've taken some copywriting courses and they'll say things like, oh, what really makes a content go viral? It's not that people agree with it strongly, but it's anger. So they'll say hate read something. So that will promulgate faster, and that can populate in ways that if you were living in a large metropolitan area in the 1950s, and they were maybe a few daily papers, you would be focused on who are the people in this geography, and they'll have some different views. So you have to find that happy medium versus I am speaking to a national/global audience of English readers. So within this segment of 20 or 30% of people who fit this demographic and or maybe political profile, I'm going to be as extreme as possible and hate read on this. So I'm going to say to my audience on the right or the left, hey, look at this guy on the other side said he's an idiot. Share this. And then you assume that all people are that. So anyway, the media landscape favors an anti-enlightenment type of discourse. So do we all go to allsides.com where issue will be presented? It'll aggregate news stories from different articles. You can think, okay, I disagree with this person, but this is what the other side is saying, so I at least understand what their arguments are. Was there a time in history where you thought, all right, they nailed it. Children ran around and read the Federalist Papers and they were showing up and every adult showed up at city hall meetings or, you know, PTA meetings. And we really, we absorbed objective information. And was there a time where we were never perfect, but we were better? And how is that replicated today?
So I think you've nailed it. I think the media models today, to a large degree, are many of them are broken, and they foster this notion of knee-jerk reaction and a tendency to characterize or caricature the opposing point of view, which is not helpful. Now, the reasons for this are multiple. My sense is that this goes back to this identity politics framework, which we're in, which really pushes your emotional amygdala-driven responses, you know, the in-group and the out-group, that way of reacting, which we all know is part of being human. It comes from our ancestral, you know, development, our primitive development. And it's why we love sports. It's great fun to be in a sports arena and get rowdy. So that kind of paradigm is wonderful for sports, but it's not good for public policy. So I think we have a real problem. Now, in the book, I talk about this and I have suggestions for how to change the incentives in the media models to be less about headlines and more about thoughtful discussion like we're doing right now. There are ways to do that. But to your question, over the course of our history, there always has been a mix of reason and rational debate and empiricism in our political dialogue, as well as passion. There's always been both. I think because of what I just mentioned, that there's much less reason now. It's the reason has become crowded out much more by these emotional triggers, which is a shame. Almost, and you can tell it almost by our use of labels, like individual words become third rails, like Black Lives Matter, third rail, or build a wall, third rail. And let me use your example of the Federalist Papers. Look, the Federalist Papers they're passionate in many ways, but fundamentally, they're a rational argument for why the Constitution's blend of moderate and radical ideas, as we talked about earlier, why those can work and how they were supposed to work, how power was balanced, and why the Constitution had aspects of democracy, but aspects of a meritocracy, et cetera. So there's always been a mix. But let's use an example from modern times. Let's go back 8 years. 8 years ago, face one of the most contentious third rail issues today is immigration. You know, open borders. So one side says the other one's saying open borders. Or the other side is, you know, focusing on them saying build a wall. Well, 8 years ago, the Gang of Eight had a very detailed proposal that was bipartisan for how to address many of the issues that we face today in immigration. Now, this bipartisan proposal, which had what has become a dirty word called compromise, did not please those on the left or right. The left was very upset because they were real controls and not quotas, but controls of immigration and how it would work. The right was not happy because the proposal, the Gang of Eight bill, had a pathway to citizenship for dreamers. So my point is both sides were unhappy, but the legislation was detailed and solved a lot of problems. That's about 8 years ago. Now, where are we 8 years later? We're much further away from a solution. So to me, this is an example of what you just asked. We had a much more concrete set of workable solutions that involved compromise and, to use your term, reason, enlightenment framework. And today it seems like that's gone. Now, one of the things I owe you an answer to, Scott, is why I mentioned earlier that the Enlightenment has become a dirty word. And why do I think Enlightenment is so important? The last 50 years, we've been in this, you know, postmodern world where the whole idea of Enlightenment has been thrown out. But, and certainly, let's take a slightly longer view. Let's look back 250 years ago, okay? So 250 years ago, the life expectancy on Earth was about 30 years. Today, it's about 70 or over 70. 200 years ago, 1 in 5 children didn't survive till age 5. Today, almost all do. In that same time frame, 250 years ago, 4/5 of the world lived in extreme poverty, while today 1/5 of the world does. The point being, over the last 200, 250 years, we've seen more flourishing of human prosperity than in the prior 1,000 years. And to me, that a lot of that is due to the Enlightenment, to our embrace of human capacity, of truth, of reasoning and what is sometimes people refer to it as the building a constitution of knowledge. In other words, we have this kind of democratic way of building knowledge that is anyone could throw ideas into the funnel. It's a big funnel, but only through testing, specialty, peer review, can ideas make it out the other side. And that's how we learn things. You and I don't think have ever been I've never been in space. I haven't observed the Earth is round, but I believe we have data that shows that it is. So that's how we have a constitution of knowledge. And my argument is that that's served us enormously well. So are we ready to just throw it out? Do we want to just embrace everyone having their own truth? I think that's very dangerous. And I think that we have to recognize how vital, let's call it the Enlightenment framework has been for our progress.
Well, I also take your point very well that in the search for facts and truth, sometimes long forward analysis are necessary. So podcast beats Twitter is one takeaway I hear. And there's a lot more here, and there's many contemporary public policy implications. There's all of the things you alluded to in our discussion. For listeners who want to check it out, the name of your book is American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Seth, thank you for joining us.
It's been such a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to come back. And thanks for the work that you're doing, Scott, in getting deeper discussion outside of Twitter, getting that to happen.
Absolutely. All right, listeners. Well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.